Hello, my name is Brian McKenna. I'm one of the editors at Computer Weekly, and I'm here to bid you a very warm welcome indeed to the Computer Weekly
Downtown Upload
podcast.
And those two other voices are?
I'm Caroline Donnelly. I'm a senior editor at Computer Weekly.
I'm Claire McDonald. I'm the business editor at Computer Weekly.
And today also we have, as a guest, back by popular demand, Alex Croxton, our networking editor.
Hola.
Very good. And Alex is gonna talk about Mobile World Congress in Barcelona and what he learned there. Before he does that, Caroline's going to talk about some recent Facebook shenanigans with personal data. Top line on that. Claire's going to talk about Mr. Marx and Mr. Spencer and their tie-up with Ocado. And if we've got time, I'm going to talk a little bit about ethics and the digital realm, kind of very high-flown discourse. The only way is ethics.
That should definitely be a headline.
Alex, Barcelona this time was Mobile World Congress.
Claro que sí. I should probably talk in English, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I'm Catalan.
Yeah, I don't speak Catalan, unfortunately. I'm becoming the roving Barcelona correspondent, it would seem. Lovely city. So Mobile World Congress, 100,000 people, 4 days of utter insanity, 52,000 steps, give or take, nearly 50 kilometres of walking. Claire, you went once, didn't you?
I did. I found it my own version of a living nightmare.
It's a little mind-blowing. Mind-blowing would be diplomatic.
Well, I don't exist to be diplomatic.
Your mileage may vary.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting show this year, and one of the most, highly politicised, I should say. Certainly as we move closer to 5G, there's lots of concerns about regulation and so on, and these were being vocalised by the heads of Telefonica, which runs O2 in the UK, and Vodafone. As well, we're both basically calling for European regulators to focus more on getting the usable spectrum to support 5G out of the door rather than on getting the most money for it. This was a problem 20 years ago, almost, with the 3G auctions, where they focused far too much on getting loads and loads of cash. And that left the mobile operators with a problem on their hands because they'd spent so lavishly on all the spectrum that they couldn't then roll out any services in a timely fashion. The worry is that this will happen again on 5G.
Because wasn't that something with the 4G auction that people were kind of, oh my God, look at how much money the 3G auction raised compared to the 4G, and people were kind of using that as a marker of, oh, is it not as successful? But it's not really, like you say, it's...
Yeah, everyone was walking around making out like they were really disappointed with the 4G auction, and the 5G auction that we've already had in the UK, there were similar thoughts expressed at the time. The 4G auction, a lot of this was blamed on the recession and austerity that was happening at the time, obviously, around the turn of the decade.
And what about Huawei? Was that mentioned at all?
Huawei is sort of lurking in the background constantly. It's a Banquo's ghost of mobile. It's a consideration, and there were a lot was discussed, but nothing official. The impression I got was that a few of the big tech suppliers and vendors were sort of the impression that the US government is maybe being a little too harsh. I certainly got that off Pat Gelsinger, the CEO of VMware, who hinted quite strongly that was his position.
Okay.
Huawei also unveiled their bendy phone.
Bendy phone?
Foldable.
Yeah, there's quite a few of those show this year, wasn't
there? A few people did.
As in, like, you can fold it up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a Christmas card. Screens on both sides. And I can't wait to see how quickly they break.
You can see like my dad or someone go up to like a normal phone. Oh, it's affordable. Oh, it's not. He's just breaking it. But what is the use case for the foldable phones? Because I saw lots of videos with people, various vendors showing off the technology. But is it, because I know there's lots of stuff at the moment around phone sales are stagnating, smartphones, that is it just kind of tech for tech's sake? Cause that's what I couldn't really get a handle on.
My personal opinion would be yes. There's been a dearth of innovation in smartphones in the past few years, it's the device has kind of reached its, I mean, beyond having like brain implants or something, the device has kind of reached its final form. There's not really anywhere you can go from this little glassy device.
Yeah.
Bigger,
so,
smaller.
Yeah, people have been innovating around the cameras. The big news last year's Congress was the really advanced cameras on Huawei and Samsung phones. This year, foldable seems to be in vogue. I can't see the use case myself, mainly because the hybrid phone tablet, which is what they're getting at, the phablet, was kind of tried a few years ago, and it just didn't really take off. And women won't buy them because they don't fit in any in pockets.
If you have pockets,
if you're lucky enough to have them, and yeah, I don't see it.
Yeah,
but they were certainly popular.
And I saw that you wrote a blog post about the environmental impact of the show, and I found that super, super interesting, because we were talking last week about
climate change
being bigger
how is bigger than something
bigger than
else.
Some other stuff going on in the world at the moment. I just found that really interesting. You said that your overall experience generated about 0.24 tonnes of carbon dioxide.
So the GSMA, that's the GSM Association who run Mobile World Congress, have they like to say they're carbon neutral. They've taken some really interesting and worthwhile and ethically positive steps to make that happen. They're trying their best. They offer attendees a way to offset their carbon emissions in travelling to the show. So you log on to their website, enter your flight details and details of how you moved around Barcelona, and it will then calculate your total carbon emissions based on that, and then you can to a certain value offset that by donating to various worthwhile projects. I think there was a clean water project in sub-Saharan Africa. It's one of this year's options, things like that.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And it's pretty positive development, and they are doing all they can, but my personal feeling, as I put across in my blog post, was if it's not compulsory, and then you can't really make something like that compulsory, I don't think they can really say that Mobile World Congress is carbon neutral, because not everybody is going to do that. Not everybody is going to take the recommended steps to minimise their impact as they're travelling.
Yeah.
And the other point I made was that networks are getting so advanced in terms of speed and capacity and capabilities, it is more than possible to do these things remotely now.
Yeah, virtual show.
It's something to consider. I don't think they're going to cancel Mobile World Congress. I mean, possibly they shouldn't, but
it is very interesting to consider these things, though.
Yeah, and it sounds like a cool idea around data. Maybe let's move on to something else, which is arguably less cool, from Mobile World Congress to Android mobile phone data being exploited by
Facebook, everybody's favourite social networking site, or perhaps not in the wake of this week's headlines. So I think since the Cambridge Analytica data breach scandal, the way Facebook operates as a business and how its users' data feeds into that, I think, has come under increased scrutiny. But a picture is sort of starting to emerge now through stories like the one we've had this week from Bill Goodwin at Computer Weekly about what Facebook actually does with people's data, that I think raises some quite important questions about whether these use cases are permissible and from an ethical or legal standpoint. So what we've got in this story is that what's emerged is there's a team inside Facebook who are called the Growth Team, which will... The reason they're called that will come will make sense later on. But they were set up to embark on a secret program that would allow the firm to collect location data from its users and cross-reference that with other information that would allow them to target location-aware products at people, so on the site. So what in this story, what it says is that Android device users who are Facebook members were specifically targeted in this program, and also those who indicated on their profile that they're single, and that could result in them being targeted with sort of adverts for dating services and products, and also political adverts too. Now, I think there's an expectation, or at least an appreciation within the Facebook user base these days, that the data that you give Facebook is pretty much kind of like a trade, if you like. It's a free service, so kind of they're going to have to monetize it in some way. But I think it's just, there's just aspects of this story, the kind of, I guess, the snooping element of it and stuff like that, I think that does make people feel kind of uncomfortable around it all.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what is quite interesting, there's quite a telling quote in this story from a former vice president for global public policy at Facebook, which I think, again, just makes you, just kind of makes the whole thing sit a bit uneasy with people. And what she basically says is that it's an email lifted, it is an email that's come to light in relation to this program. And she basically says that, you know, this is a big win for the dating vertical specifically, so people who can make use of this data.
Yeah.
So the dating vertical, and it supports their efforts to examine good revenue opportunities resulting from policy relaxation and changes. So it's kind of like, oh, we can, you know, we can tamper with our policies and stuff like that if it means we can generate more revenue, which is why that team who are embarking on this program called the Growth Team, because I'm guessing they're targeted on increasing the revenue growth of Facebook over time. So,
And remind us why we know about the existence of the Growth Team.
Well, it all came to light on the back of another story we did on Computer Weekly. We covered it a couple of weeks ago around this inquiry that the DCMS committee were looking into Facebook and whether or not it should be, well, social media firms generally, should they be more closely regulated? Should their actions be just more closely regulated from a point of view of halting the spread of fake news and disinformation online? So that was that. There's lots of documents that came out that were kind of formed part of that inquiry that weren't made public, and this email and lots of other bits to it have kind of come to light as a result, which is where Bill's story came from. And I understand there's going to be some more stories to come up, or there has been by the time we go live with this, that will come out from this. So it's kind of, it's an interesting story. But yeah, there's pressure from the government. They want Facebook to be more, to face tighter regulations around how it operates, like I said, around sort of clamping down on its platform being used to share fake news and disinformation and things like that. So they're under pressure from governments to be more tightly regulated. And then our colleague Warwick Ashford wrote up a survey this week, which came through Askenzie PR. Basically it was a poll of 2,000 Facebook users, and I think 83% of them said they think Facebook needs to be more regulated than it is at the moment. So you've got the government saying it needs to be more tightly regulated, and then its users saying, yeah, we think they need to be kept on a tighter leash as well, which I think is quite interesting. So that's part of it as well. But like I say, it's this program, the one where they're snooping on Android users and stuff like that, it's unlikely to have been done in isolation if you've got a team that are focused on kind of revenue growth and stuff like that. And like I say, I think there will be more stories to come out of this along these lines, maybe more of these kind of programs or initiatives that come to light and stuff like that. So it's going to be an evolving story, probably one that's not just going to end here. Like I say, in the last week or so we've had three Facebook stories around regulation and stuff like that. So yeah, well, I think we're definitely going to see more of it. But I think the question is, though, like I say, that I think there is an appreciation among users that Facebook will use your data.
Mm-hmm.
But I do wonder how much users kind of, not don't care, but just kind of think, well, that's just what's going to happen if I use the platform. Like, how much are they accepting of that? And how many people think, okay, well, I'm not happy about this, I'm going to shut down my account. Because there's lots of people, I think if you've been a Facebook user for a decade or so, or even longer, for a lot of people that is like an online memory bank for them. That's where all their pictures from various things over the course of their life are stored.
Yeah, it's a nuclear option, isn't it?
Yeah, because and if you think about the rise of Facebook, that has coincided with, say, people, I guess, a decline in people sort of printing out pictures, stuff like that, and just having, physical records of their life. So it's kind of like, okay, well, I could shut down Facebook, but then I'd lose all of this. I'd lose even contacts with people that I might not have any other way.
You can download all of your Facebook data, though, and I think that does include pictures.
Yeah, I know, but I know people are kind of like, but then, like, say, the contact side of things, like,
yeah, there are some people that you can't talk to.
Yeah,
otherwise.
Yeah, but there's lots of people that I wouldn't have to talk to anymore if I got rid of my Facebook. I'd be quite happy about that. So, but yeah, it's just an interesting thing, really. Like, you know, like I say, it seems to be like all these kind of big tech firms seem to be coming of age at the minute, and it almost seems like, oh, we had a run at growth, and no one told us that we shouldn't be doing this and we shouldn't be doing that, and they're having to retrofit all this regulation to it now, which is...
And like, morally, you know, though.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, should we be doing this? Well, yeah, no. You shouldn't. Yeah.
Well, I think Facebook was it move fast and break things was their thing, so it's kind of, you know, ask for this kind of more of an attitude of, you know, ask for permission later, yeah. Just push ahead and get on with it.
Breaking doesn't necessarily include democracy, though, does it?
Yeah.
No.
I read a thing the other week that said that coming off Facebook was, in the long run, it was a small study, and I forget the precise details, but it was there were some mental health benefits to not being platform.
It is a recurring conversation with people. Like, oh, I should. I went to lunch this week with someone, and we were like, "Oh, we should use the apps less. Just the apps, and that's like all
the apps."
Yeah, you know, Twitter, Facebook, all of it. And it's I don't think it necessarily makes people happier. It might in the instant where you upload something, oh, someone's liked it, woo! But yeah, I don't think. Yeah.
I mean, what's it called? Where you deactivate? I deactivated my Facebook profile over a year ago and haven't looked at it since. And I have been happier, but I'm still on Instagram. But then I reduced all of the people on Instagram that I didn't want to hear from. And then I made other people unfollow me.
Soft block thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, unfollow so that you don't appear on their feed either. And it just feels like a bit of a safer place.
Mm-hmm.
But then whether or not I'm just perpetuating my own views by only following things that I want to see, who knows?
Yeah.
You have to curate your own experience. And Instagram is a platform where you can... It's less... It does have a problem with hate speech and so on, in the same way that Facebook and Twitter do. But it is somewhat easier to manage that sort of content out of your bubble.
Yeah.
If you don't want to see it, you haven't.
You don't have to.
Mm. Yeah. We have seen more of the... Well, Twitter's a bad example because I think they are renowned for being quite late to sort of how can we make it easier for people to control what they see, how can we get rid of kind of toxic people off their platform and stuff. But we are seeing more, I guess, steps taken on Instagram, on Facebook and things like that now where it makes it easier to like mute users or just, you know, decrease the volume of some people
you
don't
want
to. Yeah, exactly.
Even though you're not seeing, you can stay friends with them. I've muted people on Facebook because they were... getting on my nerves or posting too much going on about Brexit and life is better for it and we can still be sort of friends if I've seen them down the pub or something.
No, cut them out. Get rid.
End it.
Yeah, toxic.
But yeah, that's really exciting.
There's more to come.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot more to come on that.
Yeah.
Let's move on to another story that's got some customer data at the heart of it, or at least part of it, which is Marks and Spencer's and
Ocado. Yes.
Claire.
So, earlier this week, which by the time this airs will be last week, Marks and Spencer released a statement saying that they were talking to Ocado about a deal, but they wouldn't reveal any more than that and couldn't promise that they, in fact, would come to any kind of like conclusion with the deal. Then, boom, a day later, M&S and Ocado have announced a partnership, a 50-50 joint venture, whereby Marks and Spencer's will take a 50% share of Ocado's UK retail business for £750 million.
Ooh.
That will include giving Ocado.com access to the 12 million Marks and Spencer's customers that it currently has buying its M&S food and its 7 million Sparks membership customers. Access to that data.
And you've told us a few times, Claire, about Marks and Spencer and their kind of digital efforts.
Yeah.
So it's part of that.
Yeah, it's part of that. So Marks and Spencer, when they released some of their quarter year financial results, admitted that they were well behind some of their competitors when it came to online remit. And this obviously this goes quite a lot of the way to solving that problem for them. And Ocado benefit, because as I said, the 12 million Marks and Spencer's food customers will get added to the 700,000 customers that the brand already has ordering online from them. But probably to the detriment of Waitrose, who is currently in an online delivery deal with Ocado, which expires in September 2020, which is when Marks and Spencer's products will begin to be available through the Ocado platform.
So this could have quite a transformative effect on Marks and Spencer's. Because if I think of my own shopping experience at Marks and Spencer's, it tends to be like either grab and go, like sandwiches or stuff like that, or on the commute home, I think, oh, I've got nothing for dinner, I'll just nip in and get like one or two things. I never do like a weekly shop there. But they are renowned, like everybody loves M&S food. So it's kind of like, it could encourage maybe a changing kind of consumer habits if you know that there is this option to order like a bigger shop from them.
You might go through it. They carry a lot more products now that are I don't want to say generics, branded is the word I'm looking for. So you can get not just their cornflakes, but the Kellogg's kind.
Yeah.
Not just their coffee, but Nescafe, other brands, yeah, that's something. Other brands are available. That's sort of maybe suggests it might play out quite well for them in terms of tempting in weekly shoppers.
They do have some big stores, M&S, don't they, with big food halls, but then they've got a lot of kind of quite small high street shops that make it quite difficult, right? You wouldn't walk out of the trolley of stuff. So I think it's a very positive move actually.
Yeah.
On that point.
And they've just launched a plant kitchen range. Vegan food.
Oh yeah, I'm a fan.
Oh, it's good.
Roasted avocado sandwich.
Oh yeah,
I've got it for lunch.
Vegan dirty fries. Love it. Sorry, this isn't a Marks and Spencer's fan club. So yeah, it's looking like Marks and Spencer has made a very strategic move here. The CEO of Marks and Spencer was saying that it probably wouldn't have been viable for them to build a whole online grocery delivery platform from scratch if you go from end to end, including supply chain management and warehousing and grocery picking. And
absolutely. Yeah. And Ocado already, pretty clever.
Ocado already do.
They're super advanced, aren't they?
Exactly.
In terms of, I remember writing a couple of years ago about a robot that was zooming around the warehouse, just grabbing. Grabbing things off the shelves.
Yeah.
Because wasn't that one of the limitations you wrote in that story about when M&S tried to do that before? Is they were trying to get people to
manual
sort of
pickers.
Yeah, and it's just, they just, that really affected their economies of scale. It meant it just wasn't financially viable.
Yeah.
Really. So, yes.
Whereas Ocado have huge robot run warehouses that are specifically designed for making grocery picking and movement more efficient. So, should be good. Watch this space.
Yeah, well, some other podcasts you hear people, journalists, kind of advertising stuff.
We didn't intend that at all.
We're not even getting any money for this.
Vegan food.
No, happy to buy my own.
So we were speaking earlier about our Facebook's possibly unethical use of the mobile phone data of single folk with Android phones. So, little story this week, slight story in a way, from Tech UK, saying that digital ethics has to get real basically this year. And partly they're just saying we had, as Tech UK, we had a digital ethics summit in December, and we're going to have another one this year. So, just partly kind of really PRing that, and they've got these they've released these kind of 8 things that we all as an IT community need to think about to make ethics real. One of those is to, I'm not sure why this is an action, but they're saying think beyond AI. It's not just about artificial intelligence, it's about digital activity more broadly. But it does strike me that there has been this, going back to the Cambridge Analytica thing, was maybe a bit of a trigger for this, and then there was a House of Lords report on artificial intelligence published about this time last year, which said that ethics could be the specialism for the UK in the kind of, you know, world ecosystem of AI. You know, it's going to be very difficult for us to compete with America and to compete with China, but we can do ethics.
Right.
That was one of the recommendations from that report, which I think has been picked up in government circles and so on. It just strikes me there's so many institutes and committees and things now. You've got the Open Data Institute, the Alan Turing Institute, the Ada Lovelace Institute, which is focused on data ethics, funded by the Nuffield Trust, if I remember correctly. There's the Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation that's a kind of joint thing between DCMS and BEIS.
Yeah.
The Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy Department. There's the government's office for AI. There's a real plethora of groups and institutes and so on. It does look a bit confusing, as though it could do with either being tidied up or joined up or...
Forgiven for wondering if anyone was actually doing any real work on it.
Yeah.
Or just talking about it around Westminster.
Yeah, there is that. But there is the whole question of as we were talking about earlier, ethics. I know that Andrew Orlovsky over at the Register would argue that a lot of these things are kind of putting forward a point of view or a view that is at the very least questionable. It kind of posits the idea that as individuals we have a duty to share in order to participate in the digital economy. But do we as individuals have a duty to share our data with the likes of Google and Facebook and indeed other IT providers in order to participate in the digital economy? It's a moot thing, and what he would argue, Andrew over the Register, is kind of reviewing some of his stuff earlier in the week, is maybe this is a way of making ethics supersede data protection. So if only we get these companies to behave ethically with our data, they win, we win, everybody's happy, and that's, you know, that is clearly a point of view that government people seem to be behind, and there's a real nexus between people in government circles in the UK and some of these organisations, like for example with Google DeepMind. And so on. You know, there does seem to be this kind of interlocking between some of these big Silicon Valley-based companies, UK government circles, and part of the kind of the evidence for that, or a result of that, is this plethora of institutes and like we were talking about last week with the big drive to create more graduates and artificial intelligence, etc., etc.
Yeah. It's difficult to put any kind of label on what counts as ethical, though. The companies want to make money.
Because it is that thing, it's like, does that mean ethical in, like...
Yeah.
You know, it's tech for good.
Is it a kind of ethical washing?
Yeah, part of that. Yeah, so is it, like, ethical in the state of view that... You know, this data is only being used for good purposes, or is it ethical in that, oh, no, it's treated respectfully, and it's, you know, it's... Yeah, I don't... It's all a bit wishy-washy.
You can't really say whether or not that's a certain thing.
Yeah, but is that because you've got so many different organisations looking at this and
there
trying
is a
to
ton
define?
Of them.
Yeah, trying
there
to
really
define
is a ton
it.
Of
so
them.
It is you need that kind of like everyone to get sit around a table and like no, this is what we're talking about, and just bring clarity to the whole thing or something like that. I don't know, better define it maybe.
Yeah, and what Tech UK has been saying this week is that. Is this stuff has to get real this year?
Yeah,
get it out of
the
conference room and get it into the boardroom. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of rather cute way of saying it?
The cat's been out of the bag for a while, though, hasn't it? In terms of how technology can be used and abused in an unethical manner to disadvantage people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd certainly be on board with it being something that has to be worked out this year.
Mm.
Yeah,
but again, like I said, that it's been out in the real world for a while now.
Yeah, we are in favour, are we not, of businesses kind of monetising their data in an ethical manner.
Mm.
I mean, that's what we do as a company, is we use data to make our business work.
In a very ethical way, I would just like to say, thanks for listening to this.
There's a difference between what we do here and... to bring Facebook back into it, for example, and feeding people misinformation or
And of course the GDPR has been a big discipline now of all sorts of companies that try to monetize, build a bit business on monetizing their data.
Yeah, and we haven't created a platform for hate like some other online services have.
Depends. You read the comment section sometimes.
Yeah, are you missing a trick? So we started the podcast with Alex telling us about all the steps he's been taking at Mobile World Congress and so on. Did you come across any therapists?
I came across no animals at all in the venue, apart from the security guards' dogs. There were a few sniffer dogs doing the rounds in the morning. A few therapy robots kicking about.
Oh, really?
On some of the stands with a kind of sort of a medical bent. A lot of institutions in Japan are, because of the massively elderly population they've got there, they're facing a real demographic time bomb.
Not enough
people to take care of all these all the old people. And robots are already being used.
That's cool.
In that sort of context, which is quite interesting, but not actual dogs.
Because you do see them. I've seen them at a few conferences it does kind of make sense. A lot of them are kind of like anxiety dogs and stuff like that. So they'll wear collars saying, I am here to help someone with...
Would this be more in San Francisco than in Europe?
I have seen it in San Francisco because I saw it last year at the Google Cloud Conference. And I was going to get onto Google, like, talking about that in a minute. But at the OpenStack Conference, which was in Canada last year, there was like a couple there as well. And I think if you've got an anxiety disorder, or it's like agoraphobic in nature and things like that, and conferences are full of people, so you would need like something to...
It can be very triggering for people who are on the autistic spectrum.
And there is, I think it benefits, even if you don't need a therapist, if you're at a conference like that and you see a dog and you like dogs, your instant reaction is, oh my god, a dog! And it just is an instant mood lift.
Yeah. We should probably explain them. What sparked this was seeing Jimmy Cipollata, who's a dachshund, who's being employed as a therapist at Nottingham Trent University. But I do know that other educational institutions and colleges and universities do have welfare pups.
We have a bring your dog to work policy, and it always brightens the day when someone brings their dog in.
It's a conversation starter. Builds bridges between other teams and stuff.
But I enjoy that. It's good.
But on the back, on the back of that story, I remembered from the Google conference, I remember remarking to someone last year, saying, oh, there's a lot of dogs at this conference, because you very rarely see dogs in like en masse at conferences, if not in a security role. And I was kind of got talking to someone at Google about it, and I said, we've got a really huge kind of bring your dog to work policy. And that they have, and this person, I'm still not sure if they're pulling my leg or whatever, but it seems to be like there is a lot of truth in this. But they're called doogalers. So the dogs get given their own passes for buildings. They get their own desks and stuff like that. They're made to feel very welcome.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
And then I looked it up. There's a story on a website called Londog, which is all about dogs in London. And they did a little profile on Google, and they sort of said that there's lots of big tech firms who have bring your dog to work policies. But a lot of them don't extend that to their overseas offices, but Google does. So 3 out of their 4 London offices are dog-friendly, and you're allowed to bring your doogalers to work, which I was just like, that's brilliant.
Amazon is one of the companies that does not.
My
insider information.
Mm. Yeah, so no, but I think...
Welcome to Seattle, not in the UK.
Really?
Yeah, so I think that's really...
So it's just a matter of time before we see more kind of professional therapists.
Maybe.
At conferences, we're in favour of that.
Absolutely, 100%. I'd want to see a puppy do a keynote, really. That's when we've hit peak pup. But I'd be up for that.
Cool. Well, I think we've come to a natural conclusion this week. We'll be back again next week. Just remains for me to say thank you to Caroline, Claire, Alex, and thank you for listening. And we'll be back next week. Okay. Bye.
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 Bye.